And I should say that this is always the course that I love to teach. So I may do a hopeless job of it, but I'm enjoying it. Okay. Relativity is easily the best course to teach in any course on physics. And the reason for that is very simple. It's the most coherent, intuitive, well-founded subject of all in physics. It has a very simple internal logic, which I hope I convey, but if I fail to, don't be put off. This really is the mother of modern physics, and it's an amazing subject, which continues to be our main guiding light, even though we know that in many ways it can't be right. It's too simple, okay, to be the whole truth. And so, as you know, the purpose of perimeter, the focus of perimeter, is to connect quantum theory and general relativity, which seem to be incompatible. And of these two subjects, relativity is the beautiful one. Quantum theory is the accurate but messy, counterintuitive, complicated, real world. Okay? Relativity is more like a dream world. I mean, things work so beautifully it can't possibly be the whole story. Okay? But so that's what I'm going to try to teach in these 3 weeks. It's very much just an introductory course, and there will be lots of courses using the things that I teach later on, from quantum field theory to the Standard Model to general relativity, black holes, cosmology. Almost everything rests on this, apart from the purely quantum subjects. And of course, Ben is teaching teaching the first course in that stream. So the outline of the course is very simple. The first week we'll review special relativity and tensor calculus, which is the math needed for relativity. It's very simple math. It's just calculus and linear algebra, and that's it. Okay? So calculus and linear algebra were invented long before relativity, and they are all you need to understand this amazing subject. Then we'll go on to discuss curvature, what it means for space-time to be curved, and the Einstein field equations, which relate the curvature of space-time to the matter within the space-time. And in the third week, we'll go on to black holes and cosmology, which are particular solutions of the Einstein equations and the simplest solutions. But they are also there in reality. We know that the universe is full of black holes. Almost every galaxy has a black hole at its center. And the cosmos, the whole universe, seems to be astonishingly well described by Einstein's field equations. So I've handed out two little bits of reading for you. And I hope in the next couple of lectures you will be able to decipher these papers, okay? And I give them out for several reasons. One of them because it's very interesting to see how these astonishing ideas first emerged. And secondly, to see that at the time when these ideas were discovered, physics was a much smaller subject. Okay? And so Einstein's paper in particular, this is the paper that derived E equals mc squared. Okay? Probably the best known formula in physics. It's 3 pages and has no references. And so I'm also doing this, I will actually derive this, I'll go through the derivation in his paper. The purpose of this, of course, is to give you a little bit of insight as to how these great discoveries were made. This didn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, he was talking about the vacuum, but The discovery was not in the vacuum. There were hundreds of years of development beforehand, and Einstein was the person to synthesize all this and realize the implications. And that, in general, is a very good strategy for doing theoretical physics, to figure out, to sift through the vast amount of knowledge there is and synthesize it and sort of figure out who's right and who's confused and which are the key points and how they might fit together. And then the second paper is even more sort of masterful feat of synthesis, which is by Minkowski, who didn't really add any new physics. In fact, he wasn't a physicist, he was a mathematician. But he realized that what Einstein was talking about in relativity was a simple mathematical structure called space-time. And so he put this together in the second paper I've handed out. And his point of view is the modern perspective on what space and time are. And also, it's kind of interesting to look at these old papers, because if you follow this paper right to the end, you'll discover a mistake. Okay. And you should also bear that in mind. The great discoveries are made by people who are not afraid of making mistakes. And some of what they do is right, and some of what they do is wrong. And the wrong parts just are forgotten about. Okay? So also don't be too afraid of making a mistake in your own research work. The mistake he made was to say that gravity was perfectly consistent. Newton's theory of gravity was perfectly consistent with relativity. Okay, which it wasn't, and the fact it wasn't was the basis of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Okay, so let's begin with special relativity. And I should say there are a couple of textbooks if you want to refer to. This one, are there copies of this available? You have them. Okay, good. So this is a very nice one because it's very concise. And that's always a good thing when you're learning. When I tried to learn relativity, the first book people gave me was Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler. Okay. And you open it and it says, you have to work through all however many 500 pages of this book if you're going to become a relativist. I thought, oh, that's terrible. But it's not true. You can learn a lot from very concise books. This is quite an advanced book, actually, but it's very concise. It has one issue, which is that the convention it uses for the metric is minus the one I use, but just look out for that. Otherwise, it's a very useful book. And then otherwise, I think you have these lecture notes by Sean Carroll, which he later turned into a book. You don't need to buy the book, but you can if you want. And that's also a really nice book, which uses all the same conventions that I'm using. And so I strongly recommend that book as an introduction to GR. Lots of students like this book by Schutz. I don't like it at all, but it's a matter of taste. And then there are tens of other books you can look at, which you may find something useful in all of them. One particularly interesting book is the one by Dirac. Dirac wrote a very short book on general relativity, which is very advanced, but I do encourage you to have a look at that at some point. I think it's only 80 pages, but it's really a good book. Okay, so let's begin with special relativity. And the origins of special relativity lie in Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which was developed in the 1860s. And so Maxwell figured out the following set of laws. which describe all electromagnetic phenomena. And Maxwell, again, is one of these synthesizers. This first law was due to Gauss. This is Gauss's law for magnetic fields. So you could also call that Gauss's law. And then this law is Faraday's law of induction. And the final one is Ampere's law, but with Maxwell's modification. Okay, and this is the part that Maxwell realized you had to add in order to make all these equations consistent. E is the electric field, of course. B is the magnetic field. Rho is the charge density. And J is the current density. And I'm working in SI units. And epsilon naught and mu naught are just constants. And we'll be getting rid of them fairly soon, so I won't even say what they are. But I'm sure all of you have seen this in your physics degrees. Feynman actually has a wonderful quote about this. He said, if you ask people what happened in the 1860s, they'll tell you the American Civil War. Okay? But actually something much more significant was going on, which is that Maxwell figured out these equations. And in the future, the American Civil War will be forgotten, will quickly be forgotten. But Maxwell's equations will certainly never be forgotten. Maxwell figured out these equations through piecing together what was known. And then he made what is probably the most spectacular discovery of all time in theoretical physics. Anybody know what that was? What did Maxwell discover as a consequence of these equations?
Predictable electromagnetic waves?
Yeah, which is?
A continuity equation.
No, electromagnetic waves, but what are electromagnetic waves?
Light.
Okay, so he derived these equations by trying to describe electricity and magnetism, okay, and currents and so on. And then he realized that he could throw away the current and the charge density, and there's still solutions to these equations, and these are electromagnetic waves, and he worked out the velocity of those waves, and it turns out it's the speed of light. So bingo, he's understood what light is, and that led to radio waves and X-rays and all the other forms of radiation. There are. So this was a spectacular piece of unification leading to new physical predictions. And so there are wave solutions. With the speed on propagation C equal to 1 over square root mu naught epsilon naught. And if you plug in the measured values of those constants, that turns out to be 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, which is the correct speed of light. And so let's just do that derivation, that if we start from those equations and in particular, let me start from the fourth equation. So the fourth equation, let's set rho equals J equals zero, because there's no charge or current around. Start from this fourth equation, differentiate it with respect to time. I'll get d2e dt squared here. On the left-hand side, I'll get db dt. But then I can use that to substitute for B. And so what I get is d2 e dt squared equals minus 1 over mu naught epsilon naught. So I take that over there and curl of db dt is minus curl curl e. Okay. And then we have to use this famous formula, epsilon ijk, epsilon klm is delta il delta jm minus delta in delta jl. Is everyone familiar with that formula? Yell if you're not. Okay. And so, of course, curl of E, if I take the ith component, is epsilon ijk d by dx j ek. And, whoops, I'm sorry. So when I take curl curl, you can use that formula to show that that's, of course, epsilon ijk from the first cross product, dj. I'm going to sometimes use the notation d by dx j is equal to dj, okay, just to save time in writing it out. So that's the first curl. And then I've got epsilon k l m d l e m. So this is the ith component of the right-hand side. And now I use my epsilon formula here to see that this is d I of d j e j minus d minus di di of e, sorry, dm dl dl, let's say, of e I. But this first term is just dv, and that's equal to 0 by 1. And so what we have here is that the right-hand side is just equal to plus 1 over mu naught epsilon naught del squared of E. Okay, so what we have is the wave equation for E with the speed. So compared to the wave equation is d2 by dt squared minus 1 over c squared grad squared on some function equals 0. This is the wave equation with speed c. And if we compare this equation to that, we will, sorry, I've got the c there in the wrong place. C is there on the top. You can see that, but no, I've got that wrong. Yes, I have got that. Sorry, that is right. So c times t is a length, or c over a length is 1 over a time, and so that's dimensionally right. Okay, so that was a surprisingly small amount of work to show where light comes from. If you think about all the phenomena which we predict in physics, you know, how many of those phenomena are just electromagnetism? It's probably 99%. And so it's quite astonishing that a set of linear equations, these are linear in E and B, are capable of explaining so much about the world. So obviously to see, this is a wave equation, so there are solutions. And you can check. We'll use this later. The solutions are that the electric field is a function of x. Let's see, e.g., let me write. So the electric field is, of course, three components, Ax, Ey, Ez. And it can be any function, so e.g. any function of x minus ct. Okay, because if I make these components any function at all of x minus ct, then when I differentiate twice with respect to time, I'm going to get c squared times the double derivative of the function. And twice with respect to x, I'm going to get the double derivative of the function, and the factor of c squared will ensure that both terms cancel, right, is our solution. And what does that represent? Well, that represents a pulse of light, right? Or you can have a wave, a sinusoidal wave, or any other shape at all. You can even have a step wave, step function if you like. And what you can check from this is that from the other Maxwell equations, you see that, so div, let me get some more chalk. So div e equals 0 implies, so let's say e is e some function of x minus ct. Div e equals 0 means that that ex prime is 0. And so if we ignore constants of integration, we're left with e being only. So we're not really interested in a constant electric field. We're interested in traveling fields. And so we determine from this that ex is 0, and ey and ez can be non-zero. So I'll just write them out explicitly. So they can be any function of x minus ct. And then, of course, we figure out from the magnetic field, the B field must be, so, sorry, this is transverse. Okay, so you see from the div e equals 0 that you can't have a longitudinal electric field along x. And the magnetic field, B is basically, if you work out curl B is minus dE dt, you will see that the constraint to be perpendicular to E. So we'll actually do that later, so I'm not going to do that in detail now. Okay. So Maxwell figured out where light came from. But the most important thing about his equations for this course is that these equations have a very important symmetry. Okay. And this symmetry links space and time. And Maxwell was certainly not aware of this. It took 40 years for this symmetry to be appreciated. And so I'm going to describe how the symmetry works. So let's just start from the point of view that Maxwell's equations look a bit messy. I mean, there are four of them. Can we write them in any more compact notation? And the way we do it, you see you've got electric field and magnetic field, so there's six components of the field. How could you imagine combining six objects together into a simple quantity? So just think about matrices or vectors, linear algebra. How do I put six things into one object? Pardon? Yeah, very good. So you could try, what kind of tensor? What kind of matrix has six entries?
3 by 3 with zeros.
3 by 3 has six if it, no wait, 3 by 3 has six if it's symmetric. We're going to do relativity, okay? So we're actually going to work with 4 by 4 because there's space and time. So let's think about 4 by 4 of four dimensions. What's an object in four dimensions which has six components? A vector would have four components. We want six. How do we get six? Yeah. Very good. Exactly. So if you take an anti-symmetric matrix in four dimensions, anti-symmetric, so it has zeros on the diagonal. In the off-diagonal, you have in the upper triangle, right, you have 3, 2, 1, so there's six components, and then you just minus in the lower triangle. So it has six components. So let's try that. So we'll write down some tensor. And alpha and beta are going to be, these are indices ranging 0, 1, 2, 3. And we're just going to write down this formula, minus Ex over C, minus Ey over C. I'll explain the C in a moment. Okay, and then Ex over C, it's anti-symmetric. Ey over C, Ez over C. Zeros on the diagonal because it's anti-symmetric. And then on the off-diagonal, we'll put the magnetic field. So let's put BZ there, minus BY, and BX. Looks a little bizarre at first, but there is a logic. This is minus BZ, that's BY, minus BX. Or I can write it this way, that F0I is minus EI over C, and FIJ is equal to epsilon ijk bk. And I'm going to use the notation where Greek indices go 0, 1, 2, 3, and Roman indices go just 1, 2, 3. So these are space indices. Notice I had to put the 1 over c in there. That's to get the dimensions right. If you just look at Maxwell's equations and try and figure out the relative dimensions between b and e, there's a factor of length over time. And so you have to put that c in there to make sure this entire object has the same dimensions. And that will happen everywhere in relativity. You can't really put things together if they don't share the same dimensions. You're never going to have a symmetry which connects them. Okay, so now let's try to look at our wave equation. So this is something we notice we can do. We can put the electric and magnetic fields together. Let's look at the wave equation. Well, the wave equation is made up of derivatives. Okay, acting on something. And so these derivatives, let's also put them in a four-component vector, right? There's time and space. And again, by dimensions, we have to put a factor of C in the time. So those two derivatives have the same dimensions. Then we will introduce another object, eta alpha beta. And this is basically the space-time version of the delta symbol. So that's going to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Zeros everywhere else. Okay, so that's a matrix we'll introduce. Its inverse is written as e to alpha beta with raised indices, and that's minus, it's the same thing. Oops. So what we're doing is trying to unify space and time in anticipation of this symmetry. And then, of course, the wave equation is just box, which is eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. So I'm going to also sometimes call this just d alpha, not bother with the x. And that is equal to minus 1 over c squared dt squared plus grad squared. Okay, so all I'm doing is just compactifying notation here. And finally, I would like to talk about the current. So in electromagnetism, we have a space current, J, and we have a charge density, rho. And we'd also like to unify them. So there are obviously four of them. Let's put them together in a four vector. So we have rho c and j. And again, you can see I had to put the c in there by dimensions because rho is a charge per unit volume. J is a current density, meaning it tells you the current passing a unit surface area per unit time. And basically, if you multiply charge over volume by length over time, you'll get charge over area times 1 over time. So you had to have the C for dimensions. And then it turns out the Maxwell equations are just d alpha f alpha beta equals minus mu naught j beta. Okay, that's four of them. You see, the Maxwell equations, there are four Maxwell's equations, but two of them are vector equations, right? So they're really three components in those equations. So it's really 3 plus 3 plus 1 plus 1. So it's really 8. So 8 Maxwell equations, and here are four of them. Okay, these are the ones with either the charge density or the current on the right-hand side. So we've got four of them. And where are the other four? Well, the other four have no charge in them. One was dE dt is curl E is minus dB dt, and the other was div B equals 0. They don't involve any charge or current. And the other equations turn out to just be, you can write them in two equivalent ways. The kind of easiest way, I think, is this, gamma delta d beta f gamma delta equals 0. And here, so that's obviously four equations. You see I've contracted these indices. So this is just like in matrix algebra. When you see the same index, it gets summed over. Actually, Einstein said that was his greatest mathematical discovery, the Einstein summation convention, that whenever you multiply matrices, you shouldn't bother to write out a summation sign, right? I could have written out here sum over alpha, gamma, delta. So Einstein was no mathematician, okay? Because that was his greatest discovery, that you could throw away this summation sign. Okay, so this is clearly only four equations because alpha is the only free index. So alpha goes 0, 1, 2, 3. And everything else is summed over. And this is four equations. Now, what is this epsilon thing? Well, epsilon is defined just like the three-dimensional epsilon, except it's four-dimensional, So it's defined that epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is 1, and epsilon alpha, beta, gamma, delta is totally antisymmetric. OK? So all that means, yeah, go ahead.
If you have magnetic monopoles. OK, so good question. If you have magnetic monopoles, there are none in the world, as far as we know. But it happens that grand unified theories typically, and string theory, typically predicts they should occur. Okay, they occur in a rather complicated way as topological solutions, topologically stable solutions in grand unified theories or in string theory. If they occur, what it means is that div B is J, div B is rho monopole. Okay. And likewise, in this equation, you would have a source. You would have some source here, J monopole, alpha. Okay. So that has various implications, one of which I'll mention in a moment, which is that the vector potential doesn't exist. Okay. So the fact there are no magnetic monopoles actually allows you to construct a vector potential and do electromagnetism this way. That's purely a mathematical saving, okay, a simplifying factor. But nevertheless, it's one we use all the time. So for the moment, we'll just say this is zero experimentally. Okay, there just happens to be nothing there. In fact, the point you make, there's a generalization of this point, which is that the vacuum Maxwell equations, if I take away the current, actually have a complete symmetry under rotating F. You see, I have F alpha beta is my field strength. I can make another field strength, which is just obtained by taking, let's say, F gamma delta, and then epsilon alpha beta gamma delta. And I could call that the dual field strength. Okay? In fact, we typically put a factor of half in there just to make it simple. So that's another antisymmetric tensor constructed from the first one. And in fact, you should have hassled me when I wrote this down. You should have said, why did I put E here and B there? Why didn't I put the B there and the E here? Okay? That would also be perfectly good tensor, and all of these formulae would be kind of nicely covariant under rotations. And that's exactly what the dual does. The dual just replaces E with B, and actually B with minus E. Okay, and that is that's a perfect symmetry of the vacuum Maxwell equations. So, and that symmetry actually is believed to be a fundamental symmetry of theories like N equals 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills. They actually have magnetic monopoles, and the monopoles are dual to the electric charges, and basically in this theory, there is a perfect symmetry under rotating electric and magnetic fields into each other. Okay, so this leads us down a long path, but we won't go down there today. Yeah.
Simple question: like, what is that scalar?
Which is what? Sorry, which term? Here.
Yeah.
Oh, what is the square?
Yeah.
Sorry. It's called box. Okay, it's a good question. The notation comes from the following. You know, in vector calculus, you usually write grad is d by dx, d by dy, d by dz. Okay? So box is a kind of 4D version of the triangle. Okay? And it also involves the square. This is just historical notation. Yeah. The important part of it is that I'm able to write this second order partial differential operator, which comes into the wave equation in a manner which just looks like linear algebra, something you do in linear algebra. Okay? The point of writing this in this very in this compact notation is, in fact, that when you've written it in this notation, there's a symmetry which is now blindingly obvious. Okay? And the symmetry is that I put everything on the same footing. You see, all these indices are on the same footing. And so I just have to think, what symmetry would leave these equations unchanged? Okay? Go ahead.
Is F alpha beta with the upper indices the inverse of this matrix, or did you raise it?
I raised it, yeah, thank you. That's a good point. I should have written that out. So I've invented these two matrices, eta downstairs and eta upstairs. And if we think about those for a little bit, I just invented that matrix eta. It will turn out it's very fundamental. But we have a formula like this. Is equal to delta alpha gamma. Okay, so you can check that. You just multiply these two matrices, you sum over the beta index, and work out the alpha gamma. So this is equal to 1 if alpha equals gamma and 0 otherwise. And likewise, we can, you see what a, eta alpha beta is used for eta alpha beta. So the one with upstairs or downstairs can be used to raise or lower indices. E.g., I told you d alpha, so that's just the partial derivative. Okay, so that's with the factor of c to get the dimensions right. D by dt grad. So now I could work. I could ask, what is d alpha with a raised index? That's equal to eta alpha beta d beta. And now eta is basically 1, the identity matrix, except it has a minus 1 in the 0, 0 component. So all it does is flips the sign of the 0 element of the vector. So when I raise this, I just get minus 1 over c dt grad. And then I can write my wave operator. You see this eta alpha d beta is nothing but d alpha, which means the contraction or summation, okay, of these two indices, and that'll give me the minus 1 over c squared d by dt squared plus grad squared. And now let's think about f. So I have this formula for f. I can make another version of f with raised indices by just acting with this eta on the F with lowered indices, which I have as a matrix. And again, all that's going to happen, you see, F has, say, 0, I components. Now, if this is 0 and that's I, this will be 0 and that's I. So the only non-zero components here will come down, will, the only contribution will involve an eta ij, which is delta ij, so no change of sign. But when you have a 0, you're going to get the minus sign. And so if we just calculate what that is, I'm going to change the sign of anything with a single 0 component. So this will be plus ex over c, plus ey over c, plus ez over c. And then in the magnetic component, so I have 0 on the diagonal,
And then in the magnetic components, I do nothing. I just leave the sign alone, B, Y, B, X. Okay, so all of this is really just to show you that you can compactify the Maxwell equations. I'm just going to leave you a little exercise to show that epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, d beta, f, gamma, delta equals zero is equivalent to d alpha, f, gamma, beta, plus d gamma f beta alpha plus d beta f alpha gamma equals zero. Okay, so that's not immediately obvious. But in fact, due to this being antisymmetric, it turns out this set of equations is really only four. It looks like they're naively, it looks like there are 4 times 4 times 4 equations here. Okay, but in fact, due to the antisymmetry of this term, there are really only 4 equations in there. So that's another way of writing the second set of Maxwell's equations. And I'll just leave that to you to check. Now, another interesting quantity, which I've already mentioned, is the vector potential. And so you remember from doing electrostatics that we write the electric field as minus the gradient of some potential. That's the most common trick of solving electrostatic problems. Div E equals rho is equivalent to Laplace's equation, grad squared phi equals rho. And also we typically put B equal to the curl of a vector potential. And that's consistent because div B is zero. And div of curl is automatically zero. But what do we do if we want to combine all this into four-component notation? Well, we write A mu. And again, the same old business about introducing C's because of the dimensions. A, so these two terms will have the same dimensions. And that's the four-vector potential. And so if I lower the index, it's minus phi over C A. So that's the four-vector potential. And then it turns out that this field strength we've written down, F mu nu, is just the anti-symmetrized derivative of A. And so you can show from this, again, I'll just leave that as an exercise, that B is curl A is still true, and E is minus grad phi plus minus dA dt, which is the generalized form of the equation for an electric field when you have time-dependent fields. Okay, so what? Well, these equations exist. We've managed to write them in a more compact form. And now the crucial claim comes. These equations are invariant under Lorentz transformations. And the defining property of a Lorentz transformation is that it leaves that eta symbol we introduced unchanged. So eta prime, well, a Lorentz transformation. What is a Lorentz transformation? A Lorentz transformation takes some quantity, let's say U alpha, and replaces it with a new version, which is lambda alpha beta U beta. Okay. If I have some object with two indices, and I work out the new version of it, I've got to do this twice. Etc. Okay, so this is lambdas are 4x4 matrices. Are 4 times 4 matrices. And the key point is that they satisfy eta prime alpha beta. Actually, I'll do it with upstairs indices first, which is lambda alpha mu lambda beta nu eta mu nu. Is equal to eta. Okay, so if I act with these linear transformations on eta as using this rule for this transformation rule that every index gets transformed by this matrix, then eta is actually unchanged. And this is analogous, this is completely analogous to rotations in 3D, right? Where if I've got some vector vi, then I can rotate it using, it doesn't matter about raising and lowering, oij vj, where that's a rotation matrix. And the important point of the rotation matrix is that oij, OLM delta JM equals delta IL. Okay, the delta is an invariant tensor under rotations. And in relativity, it's eta that is invariant under these transformations, which are called Lorentz transformations. So we'll need a little bit more machinery. So if I have vectors, so this is how a vector transforms, alpha, beta, v, beta. Okay, and any upper index transforms with one of the lambdas, upper indices. What about lower indices? The downstairs alpha is going to transform with some other matrix. And I'm going to write it this way, lambda twiddle beta alpha v beta. So I take the old version of the vector, and I multiply it with this lambda twiddle. OK? Now, in fact, we want anything like this, any contraction of these two indices to be invariant. Okay, like the wave operator. So we must have, so the V alpha will go with lambda, so we define lambda twiddle to satisfy lambda alpha beta lambda twiddle beta gamma to be delta alpha gamma. In other words, lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda. Okay, so anything with an upper component transforms one way. Anything with a lower component transforms with the inverse matrix. If you do that, then quantities like this will be invariant. Because basically, so let me just prove that, because then V alpha prime, U alpha prime, will be lambda alpha beta V beta from this term. And this will be lambda twiddle alpha gamma V gamma, U gamma, right? But lambda twiddle, you see I'm multiplying those two indices just as I did. Actually, I did it the other way around. So see, if this is the inverse of that, then it also follows that the inverse matrix, alpha beta times the matrix beta gamma, is delta alpha gamma. Okay? A matrix inverse, if I multiply the matrix by its inverse on the right, I get 1. Or if I multiply on the left, I get 1. And so here, I've got the matrix. I've got the matrix inverse multiplied by the matrix, because these alphas get summed. So I can write that out in more detail. Lambda twiddle gamma alpha lambda alpha beta times V beta U gamma. And if this is 1, lambda twiddle is 1, then that's equal to V beta U beta. Okay, so upper indices go with lambda, and lower indices go with lambda twiddle. We'll see in a moment that these are exactly the Lorentz transformations you're familiar with from elementary treatments of relativity. So I can summarize this. Let's see, I had this formula that eta alpha beta is lambda alpha beta alpha gamma delta eta gamma delta. I have this formula with lower indices. This is now the twiddle matrix. So let's write it this way. Eta gamma delta lambda gamma alpha lambda twiddle delta beta. You can write this in a slightly more compact notation. Equals lambda eta lambda transpose. And this one is eta equals. Do you see what I'm doing there? So the lambda here, that index multiplies this. So that's just lambda eta. But if I pull this guy over there, then actually I'll have lambda beta gamma, and this is the second index. So these are the rows, and those are the columns. And so actually the second multiplication is a contraction of the columns of this with the columns of that. And so actually there's a transpose involved. So that's just a slightly shorthand notations you can also use. So this one would be eta lambda, these are twiddles. Pardon?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's right. It doesn't really matter which one we define to be the inverse. That's right. But what you see from this, now, if I take the determinant of eta, it's equal to minus 1, right? The determinant of that matrix, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, is just minus 1. And if I did take the determinant of the right-hand side, I've got det lambda eta lambda transpose. So this is equal to, now the determinant of a product of matrices is just the product of the determinants. So that's det, and the determinant of a transpose of a matrix is just the determinant of the matrix. So this det lambda squared times det eta, which is minus det lambda squared. So you can see from this that the determinant of lambda has to be plus or minus 1. That's just like the rotation matrices. Their determinant has to be plus or minus 1. And the plus 1 is called proper. Plus is called proper Lorentz transformation. And minus is called improper Lorentz. And it may be that, so you'll get to the improper ones later. They include operations like parity and time reversal. Do they? Yes, they include parity and time reversal. Parity changes all three directions of space to minus themselves. And time reversal just reverses time. But the familiar Lorentz transformations, the continuous ones, have determinant 1. Also, you can show that because of this, it follows that because the determinant is plus or minus 1, you can show that epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, primed. So just as epsilon ijk is an invariant tensor in three dimensions, the epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta is an invariant tensor in four dimensions under these transformations. So this is defined as lambda, 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 epsilon. Okay, and that's equal to epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, det, lambda. And so that's equal to plus or minus epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. So if I take the proper Lorentz transformations, they preserve epsilon as well. Right, with all that machinery, it's now obvious the Maxwell equations are invariant under Lorentz transformations. Okay? Because all they are is d alpha f alpha beta is equal to minus mu naught j beta, if I remember them right. And so if I transform everything with the lambdas, where I have a downstairs and upstairs indices contracted, the lambdas and lambda twiddle will cancel. And the upstairs indices just transform in the same way. So I have a lambda on the left of the equation, a lambda on the right of the equation. Lambda's invertible, right? The determinant is 1 or minus 1. That means you can invert it. It's an invertible matrix, so you can just get rid of the lambda, so on both sides of the equation. So, so that's obviously invariant. And the other one, 2, because epsilon is invariant, and then these other things just transform, just involve contraction. Okay, so these are invariant under LTs. So the situation Einstein and Lorentz, who invented these transformations, found themselves in, right, was interesting. They knew the right equations. Maxwell's equations were the right equations. Okay? It's just that nobody really understood what was buried in these equations. There was some gold in those equations, which were Lorentz transformations.
And it took 40 years for people to figure out what do those Lorentz equations really mean, Lorentz transformations mean. And they mean that space and time should never be thought of separately, that this symmetry links space to time. And so we'll now discuss the geometry of a Lorentz transformation. Yep. Go ahead.
In that relation between the alpha and epsilon transforms, like if you actually write the
lambda,
what guarantees that it is still antisymmetric in the upper indices?
Good point. This formula here is actually the definition of a determinant.
Okay. Yes, but it's not just determinant. You have also the epsilon symbol added. You can write
determinant
using an epsilon symbol.
Yes.
But like here you have two epsilon symbols, the one that's outside the determinant and the one that's inside the determinant.
Yeah, that is the definition of a determinant.
That's the definition?
Yes. What is the definition of a determinant? Determinant of a matrix is equal to epsilon ijkl m, let's say, m 1i, m 2j, m 3k, m 4l, right? You're used to that definition. But if you now extend this definition, that's with some particular choice of 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's put an a, b, c, d there instead. C and d. And let's put an epsilon a, b, c, d there. So epsilon 1, 2, 3, 4 is 1 by definition. So this agrees with the other formula when a, b, c, d are 1, or 1, 2, 3, 4. If I pick two of them equal, okay, then I get 0 because this guy's anti-symmetric, and this is symmetric under exchanging those two matrices. So it's 0 off the diagonal, and has all the right symmetries. So this you can actually take as the definition of a determinant. Okay, so the transformation of epsilon is just by the determinant of lambda. Okay, so let us do some simple examples of Lorentz transformations, and then we will discover the geometry of space-time and how these operations act on space and time. So, simple example. Lambda alpha beta is equal to, so let's do nothing in time, okay, but we'll do something completely familiar in space, which is to do a rotation of x into y. One. Okay, so 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, so that says that x, and I'm going to have x prime alpha being lambda alpha beta, x beta. Right? And what is x? Actually, I haven't even written down x yet, but you can guess that x is a four vector, link time and space. And in the time component, I put ct, because I have to have a length by dimensions, because in the space component, I'm going to put x. Okay, and you have to have these two things the same dimensions, otherwise you can't put them together. See, essentially, lambda is dimensionless. This is a symmetry operation. It's completely dimensionless. It's going to act on something. The something has to have all the same dimensions in every component. So here's my x, and this is the transformation law of x. And you can see here that so x will be a four component vector. So I can write x alpha, I can write it as a column vector. Well, this is just ct, x, y, z. And if that is my lambda, then you will see that t prime is t. I've done nothing to the time. And then x prime is x cos theta minus y sine theta, y prime is y cos theta plus x sine theta. And we can check that this satisfies this equation here, because basically that just means that if I just look at this 2 by 2 matrix, everything else is trivial in the matrix. Just that 2 by 2 matrix, what that equation is telling me is that the matrix times its transverse, right? Here I have lambda, there I have its transpose. The matrix times its transpose equals 1. And that's true, right? If I take that matrix, it's cosine, sine, sine, cosine, and then I'm multiplying by its transpose, which is cosine, sine, minus sine, cosine. And this row times that column gives me 1, because cosine squared plus sine squared. This times that gives me 0, 0, and this gives me 1. OK, so that checks that lambda satisfies the condition for Lorentz transformation. So that's just a rotation of the axes in space, rotation of the x-axis into the y-axis. So rotations are a subset of Lorentz transformations. The more interesting second example will be lambda mu alpha equals to something involving space and time. So this is cos theta, sinh theta, minus sinh theta, cos theta, 1, 1. And again, what we want to check is that lambda, eta, lambda transpose is eta. Now, in these 2 by 2 components, eta is minus 1, 1. Lambda is C minus S C. Lambda transpose is the same. And if I multiply these things out, well, this matrix times that, all it does is flip the sign of the upper components, minus SC, minus CS, minus SC. And now I have this this row times that column gives me minus C squared plus S squared. And cos squared minus sin squared is 1. So this will give me minus 1, 1. And if you work it out, you'll get 0. OK, so when you the existence of this funny minus sign in the eta means that the lambda is not made out of cosines and sines like rotation matrices. It's coshes and sinches. And if we work out what that means, so CT prime, so let's work out this x prime alpha is lambda alpha beta x beta. CT prime is CT cos theta minus x sinh theta. And x prime is x cos theta minus CT sinh theta. OK. And so what you infer from this is that x prime equals 0. If I think about, so I have these coordinates x and t. Let me just draw a picture. It's a linear transformation on space and time. So here's my t, actually ct, because that's a length. And then I have x. OK. And so I have some point. I have some point x and t. And this has given me some coordinates, x prime and t prime. In particular, the origin in the new coordinates, x prime equals 0, x, Actually, let me just write these out, and then I'll do the interpretation afterwards. So if we just define, I will do that, sorry. X prime equals 0 has x equals to tan theta ct. Okay, and we're going to define that to be a velocity. It's tan theta times the speed of light. So in other words, I have these two coordinate systems, x and t, and then I've got x prime and t prime. I won't draw it yet. But the origin, the location x equals 0, which would be the origin of spatial coordinates in the prime system, is moving in the old system. And so what that means is that the new coordinates are running alongside the origin of the new coordinates is running alongside the point, the trajectory, x equals vt. Okay, so these new coordinates describe, if you have some object, if you imagine something in this coordinates, in these coordinates moving along a line, x equals vt, the origin of the new coordinates are running along that line. And then it's a matter of a little bit of algebra to show that cosh theta, so we have tan theta, is just the definition of V, is V over C, and so cosh theta is equal to 1 over, cosh squared is 1 over 1 minus tan squared, and so cosh theta is 1 over root 1 minus V over C squared. And that's called gamma. That's the usual Lorentz gamma. And then we're left with t prime is equal to t gamma t minus vx over c squared. And x prime is gamma x minus vt. OK, so the usual Lorentz transformations are just a subset of these linear transformations, which are symmetries of Maxwell's equations. So let's now develop a geometrical picture of this. Of Lorentz transformations. And this is where Minkowski's insight came in. And so the key point is actually to realize you should think about space and time together. And let's just do one space and dimension to keep the picture simple. And so everything that happens in the world should be thought of as happening in this arena, which is space-time. And so, for example, tell me what does a clock look like in space-time? If I have a clock, what does it look like on that picture? Right? What is a clock? A clock is something that ticks. Right? So it sits there. Yeah.
It just goes up to. Yeah.
Exactly. If the clock is at rest, then its x coordinate doesn't change, right? In this coordinate system. So if I have the clock in this room, and x is the distance from that corner to me, okay, and the clock is stationary in this room, then it will tick now. Okay, but the next tick is when time has moved on. And so the clock just looks like this. This is a clock at rest. Okay. What does a ruler look like? How do we measure lengths with something, right? What does a ruler look like in that picture?
Like
It's a pair of lines. Yeah, I mean, it's a band. So I'll do it here. So here is a ruler. Okay. So that's a ruler. Okay, so Minkowski's basic insight was extremely simple, that whenever you think about any physical phenomena, just draw it in space-time. Okay? Now, then you add to this picture Lorentz transformations. And let's remove the clock for the moment. What does a Lorentz transformation look like on this picture? You see, let me draw this analogy again with rotations. So rotations we are kind of used to. If I have x and y, and I rotate my coordinates, I do that x is x cos theta minus y sine theta. What does that look like? Well, that just looks like drawing some new axes, right, which are like this. Okay, so this is x prime and y prime. And here, if this is the angle theta, then x prime is x cos theta minus y sine theta. And y prime is y cos theta plus x sine theta. This is correct. What?
X prime is...
So changing coordinates is simply a rotation of the of these axes. So now the question is, what is a Lorentz transformation? What does it do to these axes? In other words, where is the x prime axis? So again, let's go here. If I have some event or point on the xy plane, right, I can figure out where it is in the x prime y prime plane by just rotating the axes. So likewise, I have some event in space-time. What does it look like in the new axes? Okay, and that's what Lorentz transformations are all about. All you do is you take your space-time and you draw different coordinates on it. And you see, so actually, if you read that Minkowski paper, he says this whole field should not be called relativity. Okay. He said, that's much too tame. He uses some word like that. It's much too modest a title for it. It should be called the theory of absolute space-time. Okay. And that means, what does he mean by that? He means by that the coordinates are irrelevant. The coordinates are a nonsense. I mean, we use coordinates to describe things, but that's just because we can't really apprehend I like to think of it... you know, when you read a book, there's some letters and words in there. Okay, those are like the coordinates. That's not what the content of the book is. Okay, it's just a kind of convenient terminology, right? And the coordinates on space-time are the same. I mean, we produce these coordinates, but it's just because we don't know how to directly write down the space-time itself. And the coordinates are redundant. I mean, there are infinite numbers of coordinates that describe exactly the same phenomena. So we introduce this huge redundancy in the description of the physical world just so that we can write it down. Okay, that's the basic idea. So let's just figure out where they are. So that's quite easy. That x prime is gamma. I hope I get the sign right this time. T prime is gamma t minus vx over c squared. So what is the definition of the x-axis? X-axis is where t is 0, right? It's the locus, so t equals 0. So the x prime axis should be where t prime is 0.
Okay, so that means that so I simply have to draw this curve. X is c squared over v times t. That's right. So if you work it out, the x prime axis will look something like that. And likewise, the t prime axis is where x prime is 0. Okay? So the t prime axis, I said x prime equals 0, so that's just where x is vt. Okay? So that's also a line with positive slope. And it looks like this. So this is ct prime. So immediately, this looks a bit weird. I've done this transformation of coordinates, right? But I've squashed the axes. I've not rotated them. I've squashed them. And in fact, there's a kind of neat way to see exactly what you're doing, which is to consider what's called a light cone coordinate. And light cone coordinate is x plus ct or x minus ct. Okay, so it's like x plus y or x minus y. And so light cone coordinates are essentially along, so let's call these things x plus minus. This is x plus, and that actually I'll do it the other way around. No, I'll do it that way. Plus or minus ct. That is x minus. And now if you check, what is this Lorentz transformation? It turns out it's very simple, that x plus prime is lambda x plus. It's just a rescaling of x plus. And x minus prime is 1 over lambda x minus. And so what this transformation is it's actually stretching you along this light cone, along this light-like direction. That's a line x equals ct, so it's a light-like direction. And it's shrinking you in the other one. Okay, so it's so if I take my two axes, and I imagine stretching length this way and squishing them that way, that's what this transformation is doing. It's just literally closing the axes. This line is left invariant. X equals ct, okay, is invariant, i.e., this is the same line, x prime is ct prime. That's just the statement the speed of light is the same in any frame. Okay, so we have our new coordinates. And now let us see some of the sort of dramatic phenomena which occur in relativity. In particular, let's think about a clock again. So I have my clock, which is just ticks going up the CT axis. So this is a clock at rest in the CTX coordinates. Now, obviously, in the x prime and ct prime coordinates, this clock is moving in the negative x prime direction, right? Because the lines of constant x prime would be parallel to the ct prime axis, okay? And so they're here. So this line is constant. Is x prime equals constant. So the clock is moving backwards. But what we want to do is figure out what is the time between ticks of this clock as seen in the ct prime coordinates. Okay? Now, the most important property of this transformation is that it leaves x prime alpha invariant. So this is equal to x alpha
which is c squared t squared minus x. So in other words, c squared t prime squared minus x prime squared is equal to c squared t squared minus x squared. So that quantity is a constant. And if x is not changing, as it is here, then it's just the time in this rest frame is exactly the time between ticks of the clock. Okay. So now I want to figure out what is the time seen by CT prime. The first thing I have to do is to understand what is simultaneity. What does it mean for the what is this person going to call the time of that tick? Okay, so I need to draw the lines of constant CT prime, and they are parallel to the X prime axis. Okay, so maybe let me magnify that part of the diagram just so that I don't get confused. So here's tick one, here's tick two, here's my light direction. This is the X prime axis. This is the CT prime axis. To see what the time is when that clock ticked in the CT prime coordinates, I've got to draw the line parallel to this X prime axis. Okay? And that's the time it ticked. That's what the person would say is the time that clock ticked. Okay, so it ticks at a negative coordinate of X prime and some positive coordinate of CT prime. Now that distance looks, we need to actually know the value of CT prime. Okay, we can see where it is, but we have to calibrate the CT prime axis. That means figuring out what is the value of CT prime which is the same as this value of CT. And to do that, we use this hyperboloid. Okay? So if I draw this hyperbola, this is a hyperbola, CT squared minus X squared equals constant. So every point on that hyperbola has exactly the same value of CT squared minus X squared. And therefore, it has the same value of CT prime squared minus X prime squared. And so this point, if this is 1 second, okay, if this interval is 1 second, then this interval is 1 second in the CT prime coordinates. So first you figure out where you hit the axis, and second you figure out what is the calibration of that axis. And to calibrate it, you have to use these invariant hyperbole. So you can do that exercise, and of course you'll find out that CT prime, so if the clock ticks at 0, 0, so this is CTX equals, and CT 0 in the original coordinates, then it ticks at 0, 0, and and this is now gamma CT and some value of X prime in the new coordinates. Okay, and you can see that the interval between ticks looks longer in the primed system. Okay, so you can do Lorentz length contraction in exactly the same way. That if I think about my ruler, here's CT, here's X. The ruler is this guy, these two sets of lines.
Okay, so that's the ruler. And now I draw my x prime ct prime axes. And within the new coordinates, the ruler is actually defined to be this length. You see, that line will be at constant ct prime. So I've asked, how long is the ruler? I'm going to ask, what is this distance here in the units in which the x prime axis is calibrated? To calibrate that axis, I draw a hyperbola. Okay, so this is a curve here that ct squared minus x squared equals constant. So hyperbola, this time on that side of the light-like direction. And now it's obvious that a length L on this axis corresponds to this length L on the x prime axis, and therefore my ruler is shorter. Okay? So from this you will figure out that the length seen in the primed coordinates is L over gamma. And that's a Lorentz contraction. Okay, so from these pictures, I hope you can see, you can get some sort of intuitive picture about what the Lorentz transformations are doing geometrically. You can also see that this whole setup is obviously consistent. Okay? Why? Because all I'm doing is changing coordinates. I have this plane. I have some structures on the plane, clocks and rulers, and I can have rocket ships moving backwards and forwards. They go in positive x, and they come back in negative x. And then I just change my axes and describe it in the new coordinates. Well, there's no possible inconsistency you could ever get. So all of these papers you see about special relativity being inconsistent, and, you know, we get them all the time, people saying this doesn't, you know, this, they play with the algebra and they find some inconsistency. That's just obviously impossible. All you're doing is changing coordinates on the same space. Okay, so I think I better leave it there. Are there any questions?
No questions. Okay. So when do we gather for this problem?
So there's tutorials.